Good evening and welcome to Destinies. I'm Dr. Howard Margolin, and tonight the Voice of Science Fiction continues its memorials for astronaut Neil Armstrong, who died at the age of 82 on August 25th, and composer Joel Goldsmith, who died on April 29th at the age of 54. Later, we'll hear the conclusion of my 2007 interview with Joel Goldsmith, but first, Boyd Gaines reads Chapter 1 of James R. Hansen's authorized biography, First Man, The Life of Neil A. Armstrong, on the Destinies audiobook sampler.
Part 1. An American Genesis. Two obscure European towns took special meaning from the first human steps on another world. The first was Ladbergen in the German province of Westphalia, about 35 miles from the Dutch border. Here in the North Rhine region stood an 18th century farmhouse and barn belonging to a peasant family named Kutter, the same common folk from which Neil Armstrong's mother, Viola Engel Armstrong, descended. 500 miles to the northwest, on the Scotch-English border, lay Langholm, Scotland, home of the Armstrong ancestry. One branch of its lineage led to Neil's father, Stephen Koenig Armstrong. In March 1972, not quite 3 years after the Apollo 11 landing, Neil was named Langholm's first ever honorary freeman. To the cheers of 8,000 Scots and visiting Englishmen, Armstrong rode into town in a horse-drawn carriage, escorted by regimental bagpipers dressed in Armstrong tartan kilts. The glorious reception marked a reversal of fortune for the Armstrong name. Chief Magistrate James Grieve, arrayed in an ermine-trimmed robe, gravely cited a 400-year-old law, never formally repealed, that ordered him to hang any Armstrong found in the town. "I'm sorry to tell you that the Armstrongs of 400 years ago were not the most favored of families," Grieve instructed. "But they were always men of spirit, fearless, carrying favor in no quarter, doughty and determined." Neil responded wryly, "I have read a good deal of the history of this region, and it is my feeling that the Armstrongs have been dreadfully misrepresented." Neil then smiled so broadly, said the local newspaper account, that you could tell he loved every last one of the ancestral scoundrels. In early 1919, Neil's grandfather, Willis Armstrong, was living with his family at River Road Farm in the St. Mary's area of rural western Ohio. Willis's father had owned the farm, and by then Willis had it heavily mortgaged. Soon crippled by chronic arthritis, Willis relied on his son Stephen to work the fields, though finishing his education was a task on which Stephen's mother insisted. Even before he graduated from high school in 1925, Stephen had decided not to pursue the farming life. He dreamed of opportunities out west in California. Yet right there in his midst was a pretty, highly intelligent, sensitive, and soft-spoken young woman, a high school classmate, with whom he fell in love. Her name was Viola Louise Engel. Viola's dearest aspiration was to devote her life to Christ. "I had longed to be a missionary, going to distant lands, but being an only child, my parents discouraged me." She instead earned 20 cents an hour clerking at St. Mary's Glass Block Company, touted as the largest department store in western Ohio. It was then that Viola started seeing Stephen Armstrong. For Christmas 1928, Viola and Stephen gave each other engagement rings and announced their plans to marry. Like most young couples in love, they were not unaware of the challenges ahead, but knew somehow we would manage. Their wedding was set for October 8, 1929. Viola prayed, asking God to help us always to do right. "These talks with God made me strong to face the future, whatever it might bring." 3 weeks after they married, on October 29, 1929, Wall Street's stock market crashed and the Great Depression began. The life that the couple fully expected to be hard, at least financially, became significantly harder. Stephen moved Viola into the River Road farmhouse, where she helped his mother with the cooking and housework. Opportunity arose when the county auditor and a friend of the family offered him part-time work as an appraiser. Stephen went to Columbus, the state capital, to sit for the civil service exam. And in February 1930, he received his appointment to assist Columbiana County's senior auditor in Lisbon, Ohio. Arrangements were made to auction off the farm and to move his parents into a small house in St. Mary's. Stephen and Viola saw a godsend in a promising new job and a life together on their own, away from farming, and a baby on the way. 2 weeks before her due date, set for August 4th, Viola prepared to give birth at her parents' farmhouse in the same room in which Stephen had courted her and married her. The evening of August 4th, 1930, found Viola sitting at the kitchen table writing a letter to Stephen, who remained in Lisbon. As she closed the letter, a severe pain overcame her and a gush of amniotic fluid ran down her leg. At one point in the perilous labor, Dr. Vernon Noble, who had been called in, said, "Well, I cannot save the child, but we will try to save the mother." Finally, at 12:31 a.m. on August 5th, 1930, he managed to deliver the baby, a boy. The child's jaw structure resembled his father's, but his nose and eyes were all Viola. Viola and Stephen called their son Neil Alden. Viola liked the alliteration Alden Armstrong and the allusion to Alden from Henry Wadsworth Longfellow's classic poem, The Courtship of Miles Standish. No one in either family had ever been christened Neil. Perhaps they knew that Neil was the Scottish form of the Gaelic name Neal, which translated as cloud, or that in its modern form it meant champion.
Next, we'll return to the night of November 2, 2007, for part two of the digitally remastered encore of my interview with Joel Goldsmith. In part one, we discussed his scores for Call the Conqueror, Stargate SG-1, and Stargate Atlantis, and had begun a soundtrack spotlight on his music for the TV series Witchblade. Joel, another cut from Parallax really underscores the duality of Sarah's life, starting with just piano and flute, but then switching gears completely after a minute. Please set up Sarah's home for us.
You know, Ralph Hammacher, the executive producer, writer, our fearless leader on Witchblade, really doesn't like sentimental music. He's very, very cautious about it. He's always afraid of making things too sentimental. So I had to fight for that cue, actually. It was Sarah alone at home, and I was trying to present her as, you know, she was lonely. She was a lonely cop, and she had lost, you know, her best friend. And after a while, Ralph began to really like the cue. And of course, it goes into a flashback, if I'm not mistaken, or a dream sequence. But it was actually kind of hard to get that kind of a gentle cue in the score at all.
Okay. We've been hearing it in the background, so now let's bring it up to the foreground. Sarah's home. Thank you. that was Sarah's Home. Here on WUSB Stony Brook, you're listening to Destinies, the voice of science fiction. Our guest is Joel Goldsmith, composer of Witchblade, which he has released on his own label, Free Clyde Music. Interzone with Chris Phillips will be coming up in just a few minutes. And Joel, another track from Parallax, which is playing in the background, is A Violent Prayer. This one really captures the flavor of the series, brings to mind the fast-paced action scenes. We're going to play this without talking over it, so please tell us about this piece.
Well, it was one of the first main confrontations that Sarah had with the Witchblade, and the Witchblade took her off guard as well. She was just learning to use the weapon. And it took place in a church, and I wanted to make it very, very violent, which it was, with the guitars and the very driving percussion. And then it ends the last 40 seconds, I believe. It's amazing that I remember that, because honest to God, I'm not looking at anything. I just remember from writing the cue 5 years ago. The last 40 seconds becomes very atmospheric and very ambient. I think it's just really kind of synth pads into Duke playing in the church. And maybe Erhu, I can't remember. Because she was really traumatized by the entire event. You know, there are really good things about Witchblade. The show was done very sincerely. Not only trying to respect the comic book, but as well as from a woman's point of view in a violent world. There was a lot of sincerity in the show.
And several of the cuts on the CD feature chorus as well as orchestra or band, as is the case on Witchblade. What's it like writing for a choir?
Well, I mean, it's great. All the choir on Witchblade is electronic. But, you know, on Call there was real choir. And on the Ark of Truth, the Stargate that we just finished, the film, which is really wrapping up the Ori storyline, we used a big choir. We used 60 men and women. It's wonderful writing for a choir. Very exciting.
The third episode of Witchblade, called Conundrum, contained a song called Very Dark Days, featuring vocals by you. What made you decide to give singing a try, and why did you only sing one of the songs on the CD?
Well, Howard, you know, we did an open call for the vocals, and we had gone through 30 or 40 vocalists trying the piece out. And nobody seemed to be cutting it. You know, we were having all the professionals come in. I'm lying, Howard. The truth of the matter was, is I wrote the cue about 3 o'clock in the morning. And I loved the cue, actually. I was looking for something to put the melody on, and it seemed vocal was the only appropriate thing. I wrote down some lyrics and just sang it real quick because it was 3 o'clock in the morning. Believe me, if it was 9 in the morning, probably somebody else would have sung it.
Okay. So here's what goes through Joel Goldsmith's mind at 3 o'clock in the morning. Here's very dark days. That was Very Dark Days, sung by Joel Goldsmith, our guest on tonight's Soundtrack Spotlight Special on Destiny's The Voice of Science Fiction. Joel, Episode 5, Sacrifice, introduced us to Sarah's lover, Concobar, and one of the more complex melodies on the CD, The Fire Dance. Since this episode was about a rock band, did it afford you more freedom to be in the foreground with the music?
Well, you know, Howard, we did a few rock songs for the episode. I believe an artist named Cormac did a lot of that. But whenever there's music involved in the storyline, it always brings the music to the forefront, and we love that, you know. And I actually enjoyed that episode quite a bit.
Okay, so here it is, The Fire Dance. We just heard The Fire Dance from Joel Goldsmith's soundtrack of Witchblade. Joel, when you write for a series, do you follow the leitmotif method in which characters have their own themes?
I think it would depend on the show you're working on, but as a general rule, yeah, of course. You know, as something like Witchblade, there were three or four themes that we would use throughout the episodes. And a show like Stargate, my goodness, there's, you know, 15, 20. I have a list that I refer to as characters reoccur. I go back to the list to bring up their themes. So, definitely.
Concobar died two episodes later in a story called Maelstrom, which is represented on the CD by a short but intense piece featuring heavy percussion. Joel, do you remember the action that was occurring during this track?
Do you? Because honest to God, Howard, I can't remember.
Okay, I don't either.
You caught me off guard.
Sorry.
I'm sorry, I don't remember.
Okay, well, let's let the music speak for itself. Here is Maelstrom. That was the title cut from the Witchblade episode Maelstrom. Here as we start to wrap up things with Joel Goldsmith before Interzone. Joel, obviously there was enough demand for this music for you to release it. Since you recorded this material in 2001, have you found any other examples of science fiction or fantasy shows that have adopted some of your stylistic elements for their soundtracks?
Well, you mean from the Witchblade? When we did Witchblade, we had been heavily influenced by Peter Gabriel's Passion. Both the executive producer and I really loved it. And combining world music with techno music. And there have been a few other examples offhand. I'm not going to mention them. But there were a few that we kind of proudly feel like we influenced.
I noticed that the CD only contains music from the first 9 episodes of Witchblade. Are you planning to release a second volume of music from the series?
Not at the present time. I think I covered Witchblade pretty well.
And what other releases can we expect to see from Free Clyde?
Well, like I said, we're definitely doing The Ark of Truth. We're going to do a little miniseries I did called Helen of Troy, which is another orchestral score. And we've been talking about some earlier stuff. We've been talking about a film I did called Man with Two Brains, of course. And then, of course, we're talking about releasing various CDs from the Atlantis Stargate series.
Men with Two Brains, wasn't that 25 years ago this year?
I don't know. Could it be that long ago?
I thought it was 1982, that film.
It's possible.
But, yeah, that would be a great score to release. I loved that film. That was so much fun.
I did, too.
Was that 20 cc's of window cleaner intravenously?
That's right.
Yeah.
And do you remember who injected it?
Well, Steve Martin.
Yes, but who was the mad killer, though?
Oh, Merv Griffin.
Merv Griffin, that's right.
Yeah. Other than Stargate Atlantis and the upcoming Stargate SG-1 movie, are there any other projects where our listeners can hear your music in the near future?
Well, actually, you know, we were just renewed for another season of Atlantis. That just happened in the last week. And so with that and the movies, I just don't have too much time for anything else.
Okay, well,
just for the time being.
All right, well, we're going to close the show with Sarah's Metamorphosis, also from the episode Parallax. Before we let you go, Joel, what can you tell us about this one?
Most of this cue happened in the subways. It's really when she matured with the Witchblade. And it was really a rebirth for her. And I wanted to have it be slightly triumphant as she was doing this, but not over the top, again, as our executive producer, Ralph Hemmicker, would not have that at all. So it was really Sarah's rebirth.
Well, Joel, thank you for your time and for sharing your music with us. I wish you luck with Free Clyde Music, Stargate Atlantis, and any other projects you work on. Have a good night and a good weekend.
Thank you. Thank you, Howard. I hope to talk to you again soon.
I hope so, too. Our guest tonight has been Joel Goldsmith, composer for Stargate Atlantis and Witchblade, the soundtrack for which is currently available in a limited edition of 1,000 units from Free Clyde Music. To learn more about the music of Joel Goldsmith, visit www.freeclyde.com. That's www.freeclyde.com. Even though Joel Goldsmith is no longer with us, his website, freeclyde.com, is still active. On Saturday, September 15th, from 10 a.m. until 8 p.m., Coat of Arms Comics founder, creator, and writer Joe Carbone will be appearing at Collector's Kingdom, located at 202 West Jericho Turnpike in Huntington Station. Coat of Arms Comics recently released their debut title, The Chronicles of Mare, both digitally and in print, and have other titles planned. A special sale will also accompany Joe Carbone's appearance. For more information, call Collector's Kingdom at 631-549-4336. That's 549-4336. Next week, the voice of science fiction prepares for the release of Dread 3D with part one of Judge Dredd on the Destiny's audiobook sampler. Plus, Christopher DeFilippis will be back with a new installment of DeFlipside. On September 21st, we'll bring you an audiobook sampler double feature with part two of Judge Dredd and part one of The Princess Bride, read by Rob Reiner. And in 3 weeks, we'll continue our celebration of the 25th anniversary of The Princess Bride with part two of Rob Reiner's reading of William Goldman's novel. As Destiny's 20s continue, listen for interviews with Patrick Thomas, John Kenneth Muir, Frederick Weedman, Paul McGann, and Larry Tai. More highlights from the Icon 27 Cabaret, stories of James Bond, The Shadow and the Hobbit on the Destiny's Radio Theater, and readings by Joe R. Lansdale. To offer your comments about our program or to request copies of this or any previous broadcast, you can write to Destinies, care of WUSB-FM, Stony Brook University, Stony Brook, New York, 11794. Or you can call me at 631-632-6901. That's 632-6901 on Wednesdays after 8 p.m. You can also send email to destiniesvoice@aol.com. That's destiniesvoice@aol.com. Destinies is produced by a member of the Science Fiction Forum in association with WUSB Stony Brook. The forum is located in room 047 of the Stony Brook Student Union and holds meetings on Tuesday nights at 7:30 in Student Union Room 231. To hear archived Destiny shows, including our July 21st, 1989 episode, featuring our 20th anniversary salute to the first lunar landing, visit www.captphilonline.com. That's CaptPhilonline.com. Now, here are the winners of the 2012 Hugo Awards, as presented on September 2nd at ChiCon 7, the 70th World Science Fiction Convention. The best novel was Among Others by Joe Walton. Best novella was The Man Who Bridged the Mist by Kidge Johnson. Best novelette was 6 Months, 3 Days by Charlie Jane Anders. The best short story was The Paper Menagerie by Ken Liu. The best related work was The Encyclopedia of Science Fiction, 3rd edition, edited by John Clute, David Langford, Peter Nichols, and Graham Slight. The best graphic story was Digger by Ursula Vernon. The best dramatic presentation long form went to Game of Thrones Season 1. The best dramatic presentation short form was Doctor Who, The Doctor's Wife. The best editor short form was Sheila Williams. The best editor long form was Betsy Wolheim. The best professional artist was John Picascio. The best semi-prozine was Locus, edited by Liza Groen-Trombi, Kirsten Gong-Wong, and others. The best fanzine was SF Signal, edited by John DiNardo. The best fan writer was Jim C. Hines. The best fan artist was Maureen Starkey. The best fan cast was SF Squeecast. And the John W. Campbell Award for Best New Writer went to E. Lily Yu. ChiCon 7 also presented a special committee award to Chicago resident and science fiction author, editor, and collector Robert Weinberg. Until next Friday at 11:30 p.m. when we'll hear part one of Judge Dredd and volume 2, number 129 of The Flip Side, this is Dr. Howard Margolin expressing my condolences to the families of Neil Armstrong and Joel Goldsmith and wishing them and you the best of all possible destinies.